Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Since 2010, the company led by George Perez has built 20 condominium buildings, 16 affordable housing complexes, and 11 for-rent apartment buildings. It has added more than 10,000 new housing units in South Florida since the end of the Great Recession and the housing collapse. Perez runs The Related Group, a real estate conglomerate that includes luxury residential buildings on three continents, but is concentrated here in South Florida. That concentration hurt when the housing market fell off a cliff 12 years ago. The Related Group sat on about $2 billion worth of debt owed to dozens of lenders and scores of empty condominium buildings, some unfinished, when the Great Recession took hold. It dug itself out, and then some. It rode the wave of Latin American buyers soaking up properties left over after the crash and built hundreds more from Brickell to Fort Lauderdale, Doral to Pembroke Pines. But it isn't starting any new buildings, at least not right now. Instead, the company is focusing on closing out the big projects it began 5 years ago. Perez doesn't think South Florida real estate is in store for a storm like it experienced more than a decade ago, though. He says the market is different, less borrowing, less leverage, less concentrated risk. We spoke about the regional real estate market, the reliance on foreign buyers here, housing affordability, whether climate change and sea level rise is changing his mind about building on the waterfront, and a fellow real estate developer, Donald Trump. Perez says he was asked to serve in the administration twice. He says he turned down both offers. We met inside one of the Related Group's latest and largest projects, the Paricio Project in the Edgewater neighborhood of Miami. It is a four-tower development of condominiums that start at $500,000 and go up from there. This is Miami high-style living right on Biscayne Bay, a circular pool deck, golf simulator, and two bowling alleys. We spoke in the screening room for residents of the Paricio Bay building and began by talking about today's real estate market in South Florida.
In the previous cycle, we definitely overbuilt a lot more than we did this time, and with much smaller down payments. So what happened was that prices dropped and people were able to walk away from the deposits they had put in. We learned our lessons in this cycle, and the lenders learned their lesson. So there was not as much lending and there was not as much building. And the biggest characteristic differential was that we took 50% deposits from the buyers. We've been closing thousands of units this year, and we have not had one problem at all with closings. So that's the biggest issue, right? The amount of leverage is much less in this cycle. There is quite a number of units that have come into the market, particularly in the downtown area. Those units have been bought by investors which are renting the units, and at the same time we are building a lot of rental buildings, and as such that's creating a bit of a buyers and renters market, and prices, rentals have come down. I think from a condominium point of view, we are at a soft landing, I would call it.
Let me ask you about that phrase, soft landing. That was a phrase we heard a lot about 11 or 12 years ago. You'll remember those years. A lot more leverage in the system, as you acknowledge, certainly. What is contributing, in your estimation, to the sustainability of that soft landing, that soft landing doesn't turn into quicksand and quickly break off into something more economically devastating?
It's leverage, right? I mean, when people have financed 90% of their project, and whether it's a single unit or it's a developer with a building, they're squeezed, right? They have to make very rapid decisions, which typically lead to strong price reductions, the fall of prices. And at this time, there's almost no leverage. So I would say that 80% of the condominium buyers that we've had have closed on their units all cash. When you do that, there's not that need to sell because you're under pressure. Same thing with developers. You know, what used to be, 80, 90% loans have now become 40, 50% loans of the value of the buildings that are easily covered by the sales of the buildings. So in the last units that we have to deliver, and we'll probably only have four buildings that we need to deliver in the condominiums, the The buildings are 90% sold with 50% deposits, and the loans that are backing those buildings are less than 50%, you know, of the cost of the building, you know, and actually less than 40% of the value of the building. So that has been the biggest difference between this cycle and last cycle. Last cycle was definitely not a soft landing. It was a very hard landing. And this one, we have seen no defaults. We have seen not one person not closing.
What about on the supply side? We're sitting in a development that has been delivered already, a new, relatively new to the market here in the Edgewater neighborhood, a group of four buildings ultimately that'll be delivered. Are you putting new shovels in the ground? Are you putting shovels in the ground of property that you've already secured?
No. In Dade County, we're not putting any new shovels in the ground for condominiums. We are putting new shovels in the ground for apartment rentals. I think we're not seeing a recession coming. As a matter of fact, the economy of the United States, under the opinion of most economists, is that it will continue to grow at least to this year in 2019. Corporations are doing well. You know, the tax, you know, laws, if there's one thing that has helped the economy, even though I'm not a strong, a Trump supporter, it's been the tax cut that has, you know, gotten businesses to reinvest. The lower tax rates, you know, have helped the reinvestment. We have one of the lowest unemployment rates we've had in ages. Inflation is being controlled. I think the Federal Reserve is, doing the right, you know, quarter point increases in interest.
It is making it more expensive to borrow money if you're borrowing money to buy one of your condominiums.
Yes, but not that much more expensive. I mean, mortgage rates, long-term mortgage rates have not really gone up that much. We might have gone from 3.5 to 4.5, but we're definitely not in the days where it went to 16%, right? The economy's really being very controlled, very effectively. And I think it's not the mortgage rate increases that have to do with the lowering of the demand for condominiums. The single family market is still doing, particularly the one that is more affordable, still doing quite well.
You don't think the cost of borrowing has impacted the demand for condominiums?
Not so much because the interest rate increase, the mortgage rates increase have not been that substantial, and we don't have that many, you know, foreigners that really borrow. A lot of them are closing cash. So if my market was 100% U.S. market, then it'd probably have a bigger impact on our sales. But, you know, we have a great number of cash buyers. And as a matter of fact, we, in order to promote, you know, to make it easier for our buyers to close, are offering in mortgages ourselves. You know,
you're taking that credit risk now.
Yeah, you know, but at a 50% level, right? So a guy that's giving me 50% and wants to borrow the other 50%, we'll give him the money. I mean, to me,
do a loan to value of 70%, 80%?
No, not, you know, I'm not a bank. I'm risk adverse. So we're only doing this. This is not our business, although we're making it somewhat of a business, but we're only doing it at a very low risk level.
Let me ask, if not the higher cost of borrowing, what do you think has and is contributing to the softer aspect of the softer landing that you are experiencing?
Well, the decrease of production is because the demand has lowered. The demand has lowered because not the U.S. economy suffering. As a matter of fact, the U.S. economy is doing very well. But particularly in Miami, it's done because the international market has stopped or decreased its buying in the U.S. substantially, Miami, New York, L.A. And that's because the strength of the dollar. It's more expensive to buy for foreigners in the U.S. today.
The Related Group's founder, chairman, and CEO, George Perez. His company, like a lot of real estate developers, especially in Dade County, have relied on those foreign buyers over the past several years. And even though South Florida real estate prices may not be shooting higher as fast as they once were, the cost to many overseas buyers has jumped substantially. So, still to come, when Latin America catches the flu, South Florida real estate can catch a cold.
All those countries have experienced turmoil of some type. Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico, which are the largest economies in Latin America, that's all reflected in our real estate market in Miami.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. Don't forget you can follow along on Twitter at WLRN, and you can catch up on all of our previous programs by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes. Just search Sunshine Economy. South Florida has been a destination and safety deposit box for foreign money for decades. Through economic boom times and political turmoil at home, Latin Americans especially have confidently spent and invested their money here. In 2017, according to the Miami Association of Realtors, one out of every three real estate deals was done with the foreign buyer. Argentina, Venezuela, Colombia, and Brazil were the top places where the buyers came from. Over half of the international buyers of South Florida homes and condominiums come from Latin America. Canadians have been the top foreign buyers of property in Broward and Palm Beach counties. Latin Americans tend to focus on Miami-Dade. Not only do these international buyers represent an important source of cash for the real estate market here, they tend to spend more on the real estate they're buying. All of that makes them vital for a company like The Related Group, which has concentrated on higher-end condominiums in South Florida. And buying real estate here has gotten more expensive for many of those overseas buyers, regardless of what the price of that condominium may be. Compared to 8 years ago when the housing boom began taking off, it takes 50% more Mexican pesos to afford the same amount in dollars today. The dollar has gained almost 70% against the Colombian peso. It has more than doubled in its value against the Brazilian real and has jumped tenfold against the Argentine peso. George Perez with The Related Group watches these currency rates and sees them having an impact, a big impact, on real estate here.
Brazilian real and the Argentinian peso. Argentinian peso went from 20 to 40. So a person that was trying to buy a condominium in Miami, all of a sudden, in order for him to change the money to buy dollars, that apartment, even though we have not increased the prices, has gone up twice, twice in cost, right, to the person. So we feel that when all this is done and we see the economy of Brazil and Argentina and Mexico settle down more, Mexico has done much better. It's much more stable. The peso has been much more stable. But everybody was, waiting to see what was going to happen with the NAFTA talks, which are now almost concluded, and also how the new president was going to be reacting to the U.S. and to the international market. And I think that while the president is a leftist, I think that he's going to be respecting the market economies. We're very high on Mexico and investing in the country.
You are developing internationally, but for those properties that you are developing and delivering here in South Florida, are the consumers still in Latin America for those properties? Are those where the buyers are still coming from?
Yes. Look, buyers for condominiums in general have gone down tremendously. We're still seeing, nevertheless, a steady but much smaller flow of buyers for the buildings that we have. Fortunately, we have a lot less buildings that we're trying to sell, and the ones that we're trying to sell are already at 90%, sold. So we don't need the rapid sales in order to deliver buildings, that will be totally sold out. This has been a product of too much being built, but also a product of international currency fluctuations that we have really nothing, to deal with.
You haven't seen a domestic audience fill in that demand. For instance, folks leaving higher tax states like New Jersey or New York or California and looking for a lower tax regime that Florida offers. You haven't seen the domestic buyer fill in where that foreign buyer has slowed down?
We have. We have, but it's a small amount of demand compared to the huge amount of demand we had from South America. You have to remember that when this market is doing well, 90% of the condominiums were bought by Latin Americans. And in the American demand is looking much more for a permanent place. So in buildings that are not investment properties, we're seeing a lot more of that demand. So that demand is going for example, the apartments that we're building in Coconut Grove. That demand is going for the apartments that we're building in Sunny Isles on the beach. That demand is going for apartments that we're building in Fort Lauderdale, the Auberge project that we have. But it's not a crazy demand. It's not like they're coming in droves and saying, we're getting out of New York and coming to but here. We are selling. We continue to sell, but at just at a lower pace. And it's actually been good for the market to reach a form of equilibrium. And since there isn't that much out there, I think the recovery becomes much faster. You know, we just don't have that much product to sell.
I was just going to ask you about the exit velocity. If we think back to 2010 and what this community was experiencing, what your industry was experiencing, what your company was experiencing back then, it was thought that it was going to take years in order for the real estate market to absorb the units that were on the market. And of course, demand quickly turned around out of Latin America, and the exit velocity in local real estate and regional real estate was tremendous. The softer landing could project, couldn't it, a bit more of a softer takeoff, I suppose.
Or a faster takeoff. You have to remember that the economy has become a global economy, right? So people compare prices with other alternatives that we have. And it's not only that the apartment here in Brickell Avenue, they will cost you $600 a foot, will cost you $3,000 or $4,000 a foot in New York, and $5,000 a foot in London, and $4,000 in Paris, and $4,000 in Singapore, you know? But that even compared to Latin America, we are selling apartments in Buenos Aires, which was always cheaper than Miami, at $800 a foot. We're selling product in Mexico at $500-$600 a foot. So as a comparable, Miami is a very well-priced market for the international buyer. It's just as there's been a shock in the currency exchange, and it's been a shock in those countries that are natural markets. All those countries have experienced turmoil of some type: Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico, which are the largest economies in Latin America. That's all reflected in our real estate market in Miami. Should those countries stabilize and people see a clearer future that does not have the ups and downs that we're seeing now, then I think the Miami market is going to recuperate very rapidly.
George Perez runs the real estate development company, The Related Group. Real estate sales in August were strong in some pockets in South Florida. Single-family homes in Dade County jumped 10.5%. They were flat in Broward, up slightly in Palm Beach County. But sales of existing condominiums were strong across the three-county region, up 3% in Palm Beach, 9% in Broward, 16% higher in Miami-Dade County compared to a year earlier. And average prices have continued marching higher as well. But remember, that's for existing condominiums, not the new condominiums that George Perez and his real estate development company, The Related Group, tend to sell. Still to come, housing affordability and the challenge South Florida has in attracting higher-paying jobs.
We need to go to the roots of the problem, which is not only let's make housing cheaper, but how do we attract the high-paying jobs and companies that have the high-paying jobs to South Florida?
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting WLRN. Expensive is a relative concept. Cost is not. The cost of housing is expensive in South Florida. Now, maybe it looks inexpensive compared to other U.S. cities like New York, Boston, and Washington, D.C., but South Florida is one of the most expensive housing markets in the country relative to what workers get paid. Sure, the average price of a home in a place like Denver is more expensive than in South Florida, but the average paycheck is more in Denver. Same goes for Washington, D.C., Boston, New York, Portland, Oregon, Sacramento, California. Consider this. The average price of a home in Austin, Texas is about the same as it is in South Florida, according to mortgage data firm HSH. But the average household income in Austin is $74,000 a year, according to the Census Bureau. In South Florida, it's less than $55,000 a year. So median home price is about the same between Austin and Miami. But South Florida workers make 75 cents for every $1 what the average worker in Austin brings home. For years, housing costs have risen while incomes have been stagnant. Foreign buyers, like those whom we spoke about in the last segment, have helped push up the price of housing. So has the scarcity of land. Squeezed between the Everglades and the Atlantic Ocean, the demand for land is big. And then consider the population of South Florida has grown by 10% since 2010. All of this data backs up what most South Floridians already know and many experience. It is hard to afford the cost of housing here, and it is expensive to pay for it. Among the 50 largest metropolitan areas in the United States, Miami is the fifth most expensive when comparing the average price of a home to the average household income. We spoke about all of this with the Related Group's chairman, founder, and CEO, George Perez. He has led the real estate development company since its founding in the 1970s. Perez diagnoses the challenge this way.
The problem is not so much on the cost of housing, but the wages of Miami. So it isn't that Miami is the most expensive rental market. Miami became the market in where most had the highest number of people, percentage of people overpaying for housing. So it's the relationship between income and rent. So rents in Chicago and New York and Boston and LA are higher than Miami. Many of them much higher than Miami, but their incomes are much, much higher than Miami. Problem that we had is we've had a service industry, a country that, you know, that is based on a service tourist industry, and those salaries are very low. Our professionals don't get paid what they get paid in other cities, and that created a problem. So I think housing affordability is a huge problem, but we need to go to the roots of the problem, which is not only let's make housing cheaper, which is part of the solution, but how do we attract the high-paying jobs and companies that have the high-paying jobs to South Florida? They're today going to Atlanta and to Boston and to New York and to LA and to other places. They're not coming to South Florida.
Those higher-paying jobs may not be coming to the region, but people and employment keep coming. There are almost 500,000 more jobs in South Florida today compared to 8 years ago when the housing market began to improve. Median pay is up 10% from 2010, according to data from the state of Florida, while the average price of a home across the region is up almost 50%. Pay has not kept pace with home prices. It's an opportunity, the Related Group sees. The company is scheduled to start construction in the next 6 to 12 months on more than 1,400 affordable housing units. By comparison, it expects to start building just 130 condominium units in South Florida over that same period. Perez thinks the problem of the mismatch between pay and housing is partly a problem of perception and people in Miami.
It's still seen by many companies as a more frivolous place, you know. The biggest complaint, for example, of many, everything from restaurant owners to people that are hiring professionals, is that it's very hard to hire good people that have the work ethic in Miami, right?
Do you experience that in your company?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. People that all of a sudden call in sick and say, I'm not coming back, right? For example, we've now gotten into the hotel and restaurant business as part of ours. The turnover is immense. So you go opening a place, you spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in training all these people, and then all of a sudden, 3 months later, so we need to work very, very hard at A, creating the high-paying jobs, but creating a population, those companies want, to count on, to make their company successful. So we've had, even in the real estate business, people that put their regional companies here and left because they could just not find you know, the right, you know, employees. Now, I think that's becoming better and better. I think we are getting to be less of a sort of sporadic employment. You know, people come in for a while and leave. We used to be totally seasonal, you know, and of course people came here 3-4 months and then they left. You know, that has changed tremendously. I think we're making, as I said, great strides in all these things. But when I still go to New York and Chicago and LA, which I just finished going to some of these cities, and you look at their parks and you look at their cultural centers and you look at their museums and you look at their performing arts and the theater and, you know, you go and you say, you know, we still have a long way to go. We can't kid ourselves. We have a long way to go.
Is there more that the development community should be doing in regards to affordable housing here in South Florida? And I ask that, George, not only because of the leadership position that you're in, but the leadership position that the real estate industry is in. It is among the founding industries of South Florida, and it's also among those that's the best paying.
Yeah, look, I mean, housing affordability is very complex, right? You have to remember that a developer is a developer as a profit motive, right? So, but the profits are a small percentage of the total cost. So a contractor can make maybe 5% profit, the developer makes 10% profit, you know? But the issue's much greater than that, right? And people say, you know, if we're in downtown and we want to call it a 24-hour city, then it's got to be a 24-hour city for everybody, right? But when we build these buildings, unless we had massive subsidies from the government, you know, we can't build them for the working class to come in.
And is that because the cost of the land, that's where the cost structure begins?
The cost of everything, right. You can't, there's no land in downtown, and whatever you can get it, you're going to pay a fortune for it. And when I go to a contractor, I tell him, hey, look, we're building this building. He doesn't go, I'm going to give you a cheaper price because it's an affordable housing price. A block is a block is a block, right? And it costs you a lot of money to build this. So we can either go to Homestead, right, and build in cheaper land and cheaper cost because the projects are only two stories, which is much cheaper to build, et cetera. But then what are they going to do? Force them to drive, you know, 3 hours every day, and there's almost no public transportation to bring them back and forth. So in effect, they end up paying more, you know, because of the economic cost of that commute, the car, gasoline, et cetera, and the human cost, right? You know, to spend, if you have, I don't know, if you sleep 8 hours a day, I guess, and, you know, 24 is 16 hours, you know, to take 20% of that, you know, and say you're going to be inside a car, you know, it's really, I think it's just a waste of human life, right? And the resources that are wasted by the pollution and the opening of sewer lines and everything going out west. So I am very much in favor of holding the urban boundary. I don't believe more highways should be built to open up the suburbs even more.
You're against the 836 extension, for instance, in Kendall?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the long run, that is going to cause more suburban expansion. The mayor is a good friend of mine, and I think he's a well-meaning individual. And I think he's doing what he thinks is the best for the county. I'm just very, very opposed to suburban expansion. I think that the government should do whatever is necessary to provide credits for development to occur either in the central area or around rapid transit stations, you know. And the government has failed in that. You know, they started doing rapid transit stations, what, almost 20 years ago? And they went out for bids for all these things.
35 years ago in Dade County.
Nothing's been built. Look at all the stations. Nothing has been built.
The use of tax credits for affordable housing is somewhat controversial. It's a business practice that the related companies have gotten some controversy with. How do you answer those that have looked at those tax credits and say it's a system that can be abused, has been abused, and has been the source of fraud in some cases?
All systems can be abused. Government systems can be abused also. There's nothing wrong with a tax credit program. As a matter of fact, it's a very good program in which corporations get a break by investing in affordable housing. Okay? I think some developers have used it to make excess profits by using things that should not have been used. Related has never done that. We have never done anything that is in any way illegal or used to take advantage of the system. But there have been, you know, cases in which government programs, not only the tax credit program, but every time since I started doing affordable housing in 1978, 79, and even before working for the city of Miami, you know. So the programs are good programs. They just need to have a lot better regulation and control.
George Perez of the Related Group. His company is developing Liberty Square, replacing hundreds of apartments for low-income residents that were first built more than 80 years ago. It is a $300 million project. The first phase is scheduled to be finished next year. The company also has been included in a federal investigation into public money used for affordable housing. Our partner, the Miami Herald, reported in June 2017 that an affordable housing complex developed by the Related Group in Miami was among those being investigated by federal prosecutors. They were examining if construction costs were inflated. Related said it was not a target of the investigation. In August, Perez told the Herald he has not heard anything more and said Related turned over all of its records. Still to come, climate change and the threat of sea level rise. Is that affecting how Perez will develop real estate in the years to come?
If I have great beachfront locations, I will definitely still build on the beachfront.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. Today we're featuring a conversation we had with George Perez. He's the namesake of the Perez Art Museum, Miami, thanks to his initial $40 million donation. The museum that bears his name sits on the edge of Biscayne Bay. The building was built 10 feet above the required elevation for storm surge and designed to resist and adapt to the threat of higher seas in the years to come. Perez made his money and continues making money developing real estate, primarily high-end condominiums. He founded and leads the Related Group. A half dozen of the firm's most recent projects are on or very near the coastline, from Coconut Grove to Miami's Edgewater neighborhood to Fort Lauderdale Beach. Together, the projects represent more than 1,300 residents near the water in South Florida. Perez acknowledges sea level rise and climate change. He says he's worried about it, but it has not affected his appetite to build waterfront properties. We spoke with him at one of his newest buildings, Paricio Bay, a 53-story building just a few dozen yards from the ocean.
Over the long run and in the short run, sea level rise is a big problem. Global warming is a big problem. We have issues, with global warming and what it's doing to increase sea level rise. It's a big problem. It's a very complex issue. It not only affects Miami, although Miami is, of course, in the middle of this because we are a water city, but, you know, waterfront city, but so is New York and so is Washington, D.C., and so are many other cities that are going to have the same problems that we're going to have. So the solutions that we have locally, such as, better systems of percolating the water, increasing the height of the buildings, the height of the roads, etc., are all very good solutions, but they're not the answer to the problem. The answer to the problem is we've got to stop polluting, right? And when the president of the country doesn't think that this is a big deal and he withdraws from the Paris agreements, I think we're going in the wrong direction. So yes, we can all pitch in and do the best that we can. All the buildings that you just mentioned here have very high lobbies just in case, of a seawater rise, Our laws, our zoning codes and so forth have made us increase height of buildings, you know, height of the first floor, habitable floors of buildings and so forth. But those are band-aids, you know. The bigger issue is how do we join the world community in lowering the emissions and causing pollution?
You're thinking globally there. You have to develop locally for the company. Are those global concerns beginning to percolate in to development choices that you make?
Again, hard question. I have beachfront property, you know, that, you know, you respect this, you know, the coastal control guidelines, which have been pushed back, which I think correctly. But within those coastal control guidelines, we will build in what we think is the appropriate way. The buildings there will even be higher than, right? We have levels of parking, which we put before in order to even further protect, you know, against, you know, the sea rise. But if we just took that in consideration, we couldn't build in Miami, right? The Miami doesn't have mountains that I can, you know, build at. We are in low-lying areas, right? Except in some locations in Coconut Grove, but even that is like 20 feet, right? I mean, we are, you know, and I think Miami's destined to be a great city.
You've built a lot along the coastline in this last cycle, not only here in Edgewater, but up in Fort Lauderdale, Sunny Isles Beach. Does, you know, do you anticipate if you could find additional land in some of those locations or additional waterfront land in this next cycle, does the issue of sea level rise or climate change make you rethink somewhat that calculation at all? Even as a developer with a project line of 24 to 48 months for a project, and sea level rise can still be decades down the line.
It makes me think about it. I mean, but if I have great beachfront locations, I will definitely still build on the beachfront because our greatest asset and our greatest attraction to South Florida is the water. Number one, the beach, and number two, the great bayfront that we have. Biscayne Bay is beautiful. So, and that's where people want to go, and that's where people have built in Miami and in all coastal cities, right? Water is what they want. You know, it's, in London is not in the water, but this is around the Thames River or different locations. Nevertheless, again, you know, the solution is global. Here, what we can do is try to have policies, local policies, that don't pollute, that don't open up the Everglades, that don't make driving distances, that have public transportation. And in those areas that are closer to the coast, to make sure that we, you know, build at habitable heights, you know, that will prevent in the years to come to have any issues. But if we continue to pollute the way we have, and there are no stronger restrictions on emissions, our future generations are going to be in a lot of trouble.
Local governments have played a role, certainly here in South Florida, when it comes to mitigating and reinforcing against the effects of sea level rise and sunny day flooding and nuisance flooding. I'm thinking of the pumps in Miami Beach, the recent general obligation bond that Miami City voters approved to raise streets and increase stormwater pumps. We're seeing some of those same type of efforts happen in the Fort Lauderdale area from those neighborhoods that are subject to king tide flooding, for instance. The federal government is not playing that role necessarily. So, and you work with all forms of government in your business, George. So I'm wondering, what would you like to see as a developer that works internationally, but especially here in the United States, from the United States government, from the federal government, from our local representatives in U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate?
I think both the state government here in Florida and the U.S. government have not really played a very active role in the sea level rise and the global warming pollution departments. I think the precedent of the United States, I've set a precedent again, we're the only country, there used to be two, and now we're the only country that is not in the Paris Agreement. I think, you know, we have increased the exploitation of land and trying to get more minerals and so forth. And I think economic decisions are, you know, sort of taken over from environmental decisions. I'm opposed to that, you know. I'm opposed to anything that is going to make the world environmentally less sustainable. I think that when you compare the policies that we now have with the policies, for example, of the European countries, we're falling behind, you know.
Does it make American real estate less attractive for those international buyers?
No, I don't think so. I don't think really there is a correlation. I think we, you know, people are making the decisions not so much thinking about is this going to go underwater, but much more is this a secure investment?
Financially underwater versus environmentally, right?
Yeah. You know, so financing and legally. Right? I mean, the United States is a country that has good laws. You know, you're protected by the laws. In Latin America, boy, you got a problem, you got a problem. But still, the environmental issues are very, very important, you know, and I wish I had the answer for those issues.
George Perez with the Related Group. Now, still to come, his relationship with another big real estate developer, the one who lives in the White House now.
We're at odds, you know. And I think that, of course, caused a strain in that relationship, which was a very friendly relationship.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. George Perez has become a billionaire thanks to real estate. After fellow real estate developer beat the odds and was elected president, a phone call came. Perez and Donald Trump knew each other from real estate circles. The two have been partners in developments and proposed developments over the years. After his election win, Trump called Perez asking for help in building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Perez said no. He says he was eventually offered two different jobs in the Trump administration. First, as the second in command of the Housing and Urban Development Agency. The second was a top position within the State Department.
When those things happened, I really had diverging thoughts, right? One was, I can never do this. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to beat my head against the wall. My idea of HUD is like, let's increase housing subsidies. Their idea is let's cut as much as we possibly can, right? So I said, I can't do this, and I'm going to lose. You know what I mean? I'm not the president of the United States. On the other hand, I said, maybe they need voices of reason that are much more centrist and are much more logical and are thinking more of societal gain, you know, the gain of the poor, affordability, et cetera. And I think the first argument won, you know, and then saying, but I probably won't get anything done and I'm just going to beat my head against this. And I talked to Donald Trump about that. So we're at odds, you know, and I think that, of course, caused a strain in that relationship, which was a very friendly relationship. And I never thought he was going to become president of the United States or run for president or that his policies were the ones that he announced because we had never discussed those things. And when it is, you have to say, no, not what's good for me. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I guess my business would have done a lot better and I would have been a lot simpler if I would have said, hey, yeah, Donald, I'm your best buddy. Let's continue doing this. You have to stand for what is right. And that has been sort of detrimental to me, you know, in that, you know, you don't want the president not to like you, you know what I'm saying? But I just don't believe in his policies. I don't believe in isolationism. I don't believe, you know, I think that countries should, you know, should concentrate on those areas that they have the greatest advantage, you know, to do those products that they can do for in the most efficient and productive way. We shouldn't be making air conditioners and televisions. You know, that's false employment. You know, we should really, you know, we have this incredible country that leads the world in technology, and we should re-educate our population so we become the leaders in those areas that are most productive for us, and let the other people do the other things.
Have you had any communication with the White House or the president since those job offers?
Not since my declarations against the wall.
This was the border wall that the president wanted to build. He reportedly called you in January of 2017 and asked you to build it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and since then, I have a lot of friends that are common friends that talk to him and so forth, but I've had no communications with him. I think one of the issues of the problem is not so much the left and the right, is that we've gone so far to the left and to the right on both sides that there's no dialogue, you know? And this country was known, look, when I came from South America, they people used to laugh about the Republican and the Democratic parties because they said the United States are both the same party, right? It's really the same thing. And they just have little differences and they would talk to each other and come up with this. Now it's really messed up. You know, there's no communication.
Has that political divisiveness had a business impact? Do you think it could have a business impact beyond the economic numbers that are certainly very healthy when you look at the gross domestic product numbers and the jobless numbers? But is there a business impact to that political divisiveness?
Yeah, I think in the long run, there is. I mean, I think the tax cuts and so forth that Trump is doing on the short run will have a very positive effect. So I think the economy is going to grow well in the short run. I think what is happening is that there's a growing inequality. So the difference between the rich and the poor keeps on getting worse. And at some point, that affects the country. And whatever affects the country affects business.
With all due respect, guys like you keep getting richer, and those folks at the median income level are struggling to continue to afford to live in places like this.
I'm fortunate that is true. And that's why I think that those of us that are getting richer have an obligation to give back.
That's George Perez. He's founder, chairman, and CEO of The Related Group. That's a real estate development company. We were speaking with him from one of his company's newest condominium developments in the Edgewater neighborhood of Miami. He's also the namesake of the Perez Art Museum Miami. Don't forget, you can find us on social media and follow us throughout each program as we live tweet it, at WLRN is our handle. And if you missed any of today's program or would like to listen back to any of the programs over the past several years, you can just go to iTunes and search the term Sunshine Economy. Pilar Uribe is our technical director. Polly Landis is our booking producer. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting Public Radio.